Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. If you haven't figured it out yet, tomorrow is Election Day. And for people here in the Bay Area and around California, there is much more at stake than just electing our next president. Voters are being asked to weigh in on statewide ballot measures ranging from criminal justice reform to fixing our state budget, GMO food labeling, and the influence of unions in elections. And locally, San Francisco voters must decide on whether to create a housing trust fund to help support affordable housing in the city, reform the cost of doing business here, and whether to restore the Hetch Hetchy Valley, among other propositions. And time permitting, we'll try to look at some other races around the Bay Area and others, some other propositions. And to help us through all this, I welcome back to our program two University of San Francisco Department of Politics professors, Corey Cook and David Latterman. They're here in the studio with me this evening. Corey serves as director of the Leo T. McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good and associate professor in the Department of Politics, and he's published academic articles in the California Journal of Politics and Policy, American Politics Research, and the Dubois Journal of Social Science Research on Race Presidential Studies quarterly. Welcome back, Corey Cook.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And we're also joined by David Latterman. He's a renowned political analyst in the Bay Area here with expertise on the political landscape and campaigning and the public opinion process. And his main quantitative research focuses on how voters, demographics, and opinions influence an election. Welcome back, David.
Thank you very much.
And just before we go any further, just want to check in with you. Any disclosures to make about any connections to any of the propositions or to the races?
I'm only working one district race in San Francisco in the District 7 race.
Okay, and Corey?
None for me.
Okay, great. And we're going to open our phone lines now to you, our listeners, to join in with your questions and comments about tomorrow's elections. If you've participated in early voting, tell us how you voted and how you made decisions. And if you still have questions about the propositions before you, or perhaps some of the races that you're trying to decide on, let us know what your questions are. Our number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. And you can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment on our website, klw.org/programs/city-visions. Again, we're opening those phone lines now, so you're welcome to call in or email at this point. But to get the conversation started, I wanted to focus first on the state propositions. So, Corey Cook, well, let's take them in some chunks and some batches here.
Okay.
There's a few kind of common themes. The first is California state taxes and initiatives to raise taxes and tax revenue, not only from the personal income level, but also for businesses. So those are Props 30, 38, and 39. Right. So people have often talked about how Californians want their services but don't want to pay any more for it. There's been, and in our state, we set a high bar for passing new legislation or propositions, that authorize new taxing power. How do you see these three propositions addressing that, and do you feel that California voters are in any different a place than they have been around voting more taxes for themselves or voting more taxes upon themselves?
I'll start with the last part. I'm not at all convinced voters are more likely to want to tax themselves this time around. If you believe any of the public polling that's been done on these, I think the most significant of the three is Prop 30 in terms of its long-term effect on the budget, and it's polling right around 50%. And so I think we're going to be probably spending a few days after the election figuring out what happened to Prop 30. 38's got some challenges I'm happy to talk about. I think 39 is a smaller tax. It's about a billion a year. I think 39 was done very, very well. It's supported in large part by Tom Steyer from Farallon Capital Management. He's a venture capitalist who's done a lot of important work around green technology. And I think he's really crafted a very smart initiative in Prop 39. If I had to guess, I think 39 is probably in the best shape of the three, although I haven't seen a lot of polling on it.
And what would 39 do?
So 39, basically, was a loophole created by the state legislature that lets businesses decide whether they want to pay state tax or not, or pay out of state tax, and allows them to calculate their tax liability based on the percentage of business that they do in California. What it does is it gives businesses the opportunity to choose not to to avoid state taxes, and as a result, a lot of businesses have chosen to do that. So what it does is it levies about $1 billion in taxes. It basically closes that loophole. It requires local businesses businesses not to choose anymore, and then it dedicates about half of the money that would be generated from this towards clean energy, green technology sort of investments. And so I think, my sense is this is actually the kind of tax increase that voters are typically willing to vote for, because it's a tax on a very, very narrow group. Again, the perception, at least, is that it was a loophole that was created, and it's the kind of thing that voters typically do go for. It's the broad-based tax increase, particularly sales tax, that voters dislike, and I think that's the challenge with Prop 30.
And I do want to go to Prop 30 next. So that is the prop that is supported by our governor, Brown, attempts to raise tax revenue to support public safety programs and education. Tell us a little bit more about that one.
So, again, it depends on your perspective of whether you think this was a good thing or a bad thing. But effectively, what the state legislature did, voters historically, as you noted in the introduction, like to vote for spending increases and then choose not to vote for tax increases. And they have effectively avoided making any trade-off by saying, the state can just solve the problem through cutting waste, abuse, and fraud, or can figure out some way of managing those twin imperatives created by voters. What Prop 30 did was in order to frame this very clearly for voters, the legislature and the governor enacted a budget this past year that had automatic trigger cuts in effect. In effect, they budgeted saying Prop 30 will pass. And Prop 30 has some temporary sales tax increases and some temporary income tax increases on those making, I believe it's $250,000 a year or more. Those are temporary tax increases. But the budget says, let's assume those things will pass. And if they pass, then the budget is balanced. If they don't pass, there are trigger cuts that go into effect right away. So what it says to voters is, look, you can vote for this or not, but there is a clear choice that you're making. If you don't vote for it, the trigger cuts will go into effect. So you have, you can't make it a false trade-off between the two. You either vote for Prop 30, or there will be immediate cuts in K-12 education, higher education, and in some public safety programs. So voters can't sort of avoid the implications of if they don't vote for the tax increase.
And as you said earlier, doesn't seem to be swaying voters a ton.
Well, I think it is swaying voters a ton to get to close, frankly.
But not close enough?
Well, we'll see. But if you look at, for example, these types of tax revenue measures that Governor Schwarzenegger had on the ballot, they were demolished. They were not popular at all. And so I think he's gotten near 50% with the argument that, public school years will end 3 weeks early, for example. And this is one of the arguments that's made. If this isn't enacted, it creates a clear choice for voters to make. Opponents of it, of course, say that, Jerry Brown's holding the state hostage and that he's sort of put voters over a barrel. I think that's actually true, that he has put voters over a barrel in terms of making voters make a clear choice on this or not.
And the important distinction here, as we turn to Prop 38 in just a moment, is that it's going to raise individual income tax on individuals making more than $250,000 a year, or couples making more than $500,000 a year, while it also raises the state sales tax by a quarter of a cent. How does that differ from Prop 38?
Well, there are two things that differ. One is, what Prop 30 does, it says the money goes to the state general fund to deal with the historical structural budget deficit that we have in California. So it does say the legislature can allocate the money however they want. And so the ads that the No Side is running says there's no new money for schools. And technically that is true. There isn't new money for schools. It's backfilling old money for schools. But it goes to the state, to the state's general fund. And so in year one, we know exactly where it's going to go. In year two, we don't know if the legislature will choose to allocate that to schools or to public safety or to whatever, but presumably it goes to the general fund, and I assume that the legislature and the governor will make decisions based on what they historically have seen as the priorities of the state of California, which is about 40% of the state money goes to schools and so forth. What 38 does is it creates a broad-based income tax. It increases income taxes on basically everybody who pays income taxes in California. It generates more revenue than 30. 30 creates about $6 billion in revenue. 38 creates roughly $10 billion in revenue. But it specifically says this is going to be new money for schools. So it doesn't deal with the state budget problems or sort of backfilling the structural budget deficit. What it does, it says, you know, of this $10 billion that's going to be raised, 60% of that will go through K-12, 30% will go to pay back state debts, and 10% will go to early childhood programs. And so it has, it's sort of more of the allocation of program money for tax revenue, which is something we do in California. We say we'll raise X, Y, and Z tax, and the money is earmarked to a certain purpose.
So it's protected in some way.
So it's protected in some way, and at the same time, I mean, there are those who study state budgets and say this is part of the problem, is that the legislature doesn't have any flexibility in creating setting state priorities, and that effectively, 40% of the state budget goes to education by virtue of Proposition 98, which is in the state constitution. So what this money does is actually does create new funding for California schools. But it's only for California schools. It doesn't actually deal with the state budget problem. And so there are sort of twin ways of dealing with what's gone on the last few years, which is, you know, massive historic cuts in the state budget. One says, let's deal with the structural budget deficit. And at least in this year, we know that will, backfill money that otherwise would be subject to trigger cuts. Prop 38 says, let's raise more money and let's guarantee it'll go through early childhood and education spending. So there are sort of different approaches. The fun part, and the thing that I think political scientists love about these two, is what happens if they both pass. And that's what I think, you know, again, it's unlikely to happen given the polling we've seen. But that's the interesting question, I think, is when you have these sort of competing ballot measures.
So what does happen?
Well, I mean, so we're not really sure. So effectively, what the court does is they decide where they contradict the ballot measure that got the most votes is enacted. The question is whether the court would see these as being entirely in conflict with one another, or whether it would only be in conflict on the particular provisions of state income tax where they clearly do contradict, which is a broad-based income tax or a one that focuses on high-income earners. And so it's conceivable that if they were to both pass, that they would take the sales tax increase from Prop 30 and potentially even the large income increase, income tax increase on high-income earners from Prop 30, and then enact the broad-based tax increases that are enclosed in 38. So potentially there's some groups are saying, let's just say yes to both and let the court sort it out, because it's going to be a potentially large boon for California. I don't think anybody really knows what the court will do. Conceivably, they could strike an entire measure and say these were clearly presented as alternatives, and the one that gets the most votes wins and the other one doesn't. Or they could try to patch the two of them together and save as much as possible.
And how quickly will that be sorted out, considering the fact that if 30 does not pass, then there's automatic cuts to education in the middle of the school year?
Well, that'll be sorted out right away. I mean, we'll know on election day if we're going to have trigger cuts. And again, without getting into how folks ought to vote on 30, I think, you know, that would have immediate consequences in California. I think we'll see the disparities between school districts will emerge immediately. There's some school districts that could weather that. And there are some school districts that would overnight, like I said, have to end the school year rather quickly. And so I think, you know, we'll know within a day or two how that sorts out. If they both pass, and I think, you know, in the Bay Area, at least, there are a lot of folks who seem to be rooting for both of them to pass. That's when it'll be really interesting to see how the courts sort it out. And that would take a lot of time.
So 30, just to summarize, is a personal tax increase on high-income earners above $250,000 and a state sales tax increase on everyone. And the funds go to education and public safety. And in the case of 38, it's an earmarked or set-aside funding that asks everyone to chip in to an additional additional income tax and is earmarked specifically for education. So let's go to our first caller, 415-841-4134, if you'd like to join our conversation tonight. And we have Bob. Welcome to the program, Bob. Bob, are you there? All right. We thought we had Bob, but doesn't look like we do. But David, it looks like you wanted to say something about 30 and 38. No?
Well, I think Corey did a pretty good job in bringing it all together and what the two of them are. Clearly, polling right now shows that 38 is unlikely to pass, and 30 is right at the 50% mark. And I think Governor Brown and a lot of the supporters for 30 are hoping that a lot of the new registrants and a lot of folks are going to make last-minute decisions to support 30. But it could be several days before we know what the result of 30 actually is.
And why isn't this doesn't a two-thirds threshold apply in this case for 30?
It's just a general state tax increase, so it doesn't require two-thirds. Local increases would, but the state increases can happen just on the state ballot.
I see.
And to build a little bit on David's point, I mean, Jerry Brown is all in on this. If 30 does not pass, this will devastate his governorship, I think. I mean, his ability to negotiate with the Republicans in the legislature is largely premised upon his ability to deliver votes on tax measures like this. He said said when he was elected that he would not pursue any tax increases that didn't have public support. If this doesn't pass, I think he's going to have enormous difficulty getting anything in his legislative agenda done. I think this is he's and he's spending every ounce of his governorship right now trying to get this done.
So we were mentioning Prop 39 there, which is requiring businesses to pay taxes based on their sales within California, and that just reminds me, David, of San Francisco's Proposition E, which is looking to reform the way businesses pay for the cost of doing business here, moving from a payroll tax to a gross receipts tax. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that proposition?
So changing the San Francisco tax structure has been on the table for many years, and there have been halting efforts to move away from a payroll tax to a gross receipts tax or some hybrid of such. And there have been a lot of meetings over the years. There have been a lot of political folks, business folks, union folks trying to bring this all together. But finally, with Mayor Lee coming into office and tech being very important to him and job growth, when Mayor Lee was elected, his mantra was jobs, jobs, jobs. I mean, it was really what the entire 2011 mayoral race was about. And Mayor Lee has a lot of backing from the tech community, who basically want not to have new jobs taxed. So Prop E is a way to basically shift the burden so new jobs aren't taxed anymore.
And this is while new companies are just actually still trying to grow their revenue.
Sure, and obviously the redeveloping mid-market and the tech industry, we're in boom 2.0 or 3.0 or whatever you want to call it. But a lot of new companies are coming in, and startups and second and third VC round funding companies are here. You know, they're hoping to create more and more jobs, and they don't want any sort of check on that. And so this tax structure is designed, it does other things too and closes some loopholes, but ostensibly this is a way to help some tech companies add jobs without being dinged. And some of these are high paying jobs as well.
My understanding that on top of that, though, there's also a business registration fee that has was added to this, because originally it was supposed to be revenue neutral.
Right, and it increases fees a little bit. I like a small business, I think, goes from a $25 registration to $75. So there are other fees. And there are other loopholes that it closes as well. But, mainly this is what Mayor Lee has done at the behest of tech companies and some other firms. But this is something that has been endorsed by pretty much everybody in San Francisco. Prop E will pass. And I think if you look at the laundry list of people who endorse it or don't endorse it, pretty much everybody endorses it. So I think most people now understand that the current system is antiquated, and it's time to move on.
And does this allow city government to do anything to revisit some of the deals that have been struck with some of the new companies that have allowed them to?
I don't believe so. I think you mean like the Twitter tax break?
Exactly.
I think that's still on the table. I think that's still that's an active, that was part of the deal to bring Twitter and a couple other companies here to also as part of the greater effort to redo mid-market and to clean it up or to redevelop it. And then so whatever deals were struck there hold. And then the question is moving forward whether or not they're going to be accepted by the greater political community, because now there's a more codified thing in place.
Okay. And in case you're just joining us, this is our Proposition Rundown here on City Visions at 91.7 KALW San Francisco and KALW.org on the eve of Election Day. And with our guests here from the University of San Francisco, Corey Cook and David Latterman, 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment on our website, KALW.org/programs/city-visions. And I believe Bob is back on the line. Okay, Bob, here's your second chance. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm sorry I don't call often, so I didn't have a good idea when to speak. So my concern about Proposition 39 is this really is an existing rule for multi-state taxpayers. It's been around since 2009, and companies collect a sales factor really if they're based in California, because when you use the three-factor formula, it's sales, property, and payroll. So a company based in California, because they're based in California, they have most of their apportionment, and only their sales lets them out of the state. only their sales tax are allowed them to allocate or apportion income out of the state. Now, for an out-of-state, out of California, out-of-state taxpayer, it's drawing their revenue in because they no longer get to use these three-factor formulas. But that's not what the real goal or impact of Proposition 39 is going to be. California is in some real dire straits as far as income and taxes. And what this proposition does is it earmarks 50% of it for clean energy. And if California is in such dire straits in the general fund, why would you take such a new large tax increase or potentially large tax increase and just devote it to clean energy? That is the job of your legislators and your Congress in the state Senate, the state Congress. They should choose how they should afford, how they should use their revenues. And this proposition specifically says that it's going to take a huge amount of the revenue and put into efficient energy, which is a goal in and of itself, but it shouldn't be decided by a proposition like this. It should be decided by your legislators. And I think when you actually read the final word of the summary of Proposition 39, it's almost ridiculous. It's comical. It says, of the remaining revenues, a significant portion likely would be spent on schools. So they're not even telling you how much would be spent on schools and what's going to actually happen with this revenue. So I think it's a poor proposition because your legislators, who you elect, should choose where the funds go and where the taxes collected go, and they should be able to choose their priorities. So to really devote it solely to clean energy, which, again, is a good goal in and of itself, but it shouldn't really be decided by a proposition.
Thanks so much, Bob, for your call. So, Corey, isn't this the issue that comes up every election season about why are voters being asked to do all this, deciding, shouldn't we leave it in the hands of the legislators? But you,
so yeah.
But anyway, that's the main question. But then, any response specifically to Bob?
I mean, you know, I think certainly that's a valid perspective. I think what's interesting about ballot measures that are tax increases like this one is that there are really two questions that voters have. One is, do you like the source of the revenue? Do you like taxing businesses? Do you like sales tax increases? Do you like income tax increases? Do you like cigarette tax increases? For example, Prop 29 that was on the ballot in June. And then the second part is, do you like where the money goes? And the no side is particularly effective at always tearing apart where the money goes. So on the cigarette taxes, the money was going to go in Prop 29 to cancer research. And the no side made an argument that cancer research shouldn't be a priority. It should go in the state general fund. So then Prop 30 says the money should go in the state general fund. The same group that ran the No on 29 campaign is running the No on 30 campaign. And now they're saying, why would you trust Sacramento politicians to put money in the general fund? It should be earmarked specifically. So we can't trust them to spend money on education because it goes in the state general fund. And so I think you can make the argument of, should we be taxing businesses, yes or no? And I think you could, should we spend half the revenue on green technology, job training programs, green retrofitting of state facilities, et cetera, which Proposition 39 does. But there's really no perfect proposition, right? Because voters are going to look at both sides of it, and it's very easy to write a campaign ad saying, they should have had a different priority than what they did.
And I think that's a really interesting point that Corey touched on. And when you look at the no side to a lot of these ballot measures, whether it's 30 or 38 or 39 and Prop B in San Francisco, what you notice is
that's the Parks bond.
That is the Parks bond. And this is California is a Democratic state. San Francisco is a very Democratic city. And often in America, the debate is over whether we should tax more, tax less, cut spending. In California, it's sort of assumed at this point that this is a relatively liberal population. This is I won't call it a tax and spend state. There are many more tax and spend liberals as such as there than in other parts of the United States. So the arguments against these measures in California aren't on that. It's not that debate any longer. The anti-tax people have kind of lost that debate. The philosophical underpinnings of should we tax ourselves. So a lot of the arguments against them now are, do they know how to spend the money? They've shifted from you shouldn't tax yourself or schools aren't important or cancer research isn't important. That isn't the tack they take. It's now, you're right. We should have more money for schools. However, do you really trust the Sacramento politicians to spend your money correctly? Yes, we desperately want to give you money. Please take our money. But they don't know what to do with it. And then Prop B in San Francisco, the no on the Parks bond is saying the same thing. It's absolutely, we need parks. We need more money for parks. However, do you trust Reichen Park to spend your money correctly. So it's interesting how they've sort of given up one debate that's still being fought in other places in the country, and they've shifted the argument to they don't know how to spend the money.
And since you mentioned a Proposition B, we're just going to rattle them off as you bring them up. That is looking to help finance much-needed capital improvements. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit more about that.
So I'm not an expert on the mechanics of bond financing, but this is the next version of the Parks Bond. Parks, Reichen Parks in San Francisco goes back to the voters every, I think the last one was, I'm going to say 02. Maybe somebody can call and correct me, but it was several years ago. And it's a set of money in order to for capital improvements, for maintenance, for fixing playgrounds, for rec centers. And this year is its turn for another round of funding. And the problem this year is that there's actually a small but vocal opposition to Prop B.
So there were two previous bonds, one in 2000 for $110 million and one in 2008 for $185.
Right. So this is the new... this is the next round of it. And unlike previous years, there is a bit more of a spirited opposition to Prop B. And
why is that?
There are a few reasons. There are some people who don't like the director of Reichen Park, and I think it's just personal politics. There are some folks in San Francisco who used to have power who don't, who are looking to become relevant again. And there are people who honestly believe that money shouldn't be going to parks and playgrounds and they should be going elsewhere. So this, for polling that we've seen on Prop B, it's real close. It's 66.6, give or take. So this thing's going to go down to the wire.
So parks aren't a shoo-in in this particular climate.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, 60, yes and no. I mean, 66 is still a lot of voters. I mean, two-thirds of the electorate pretty much do want this, but we need two-thirds exactly, and there's just enough of an opposite. In any bond measure in San Francisco, you have an automatic 25% or so who are going to vote no. A lot of them are more fiscal conservatives. But you've also have an element on what we would call the far left that is also usually reflexively anti-bond as well, because they don't want to give money to what they see as the establishment. So with the two of them together, there's usually an auto 25-30% that is no on any bond at any time. So there's a very small margin of people to convince. And that's why most bonds, like the streets bond last year, came in at like just at 68. And so that's why they're always hovering right about that two-thirds. And so there's literally a 5-10% part of the electorate that's a swing on this.
And my understanding from reading a lot of these measures, like the parcel tax for City College and for the Parks Bond, is that there are these independent oversight committees that are supposed to make sure mm-hmm. that the money is being spent properly. What's your sense about that?
Well, I think that they do a good job. I mean, at this point, I mean, maybe 10, 15 years ago, bond oversight was a little more lax. And spending was a little more lax than it is today. But now, especially with internet's part of it, I mean, the fact that so many more people have a lot more information and sunshine laws, people know how the money is spent. And there are people who watch the money very, very closely. So I have to believe that, as these big bond measures come in, that money is being watched and how it's spent. And Community College, Prop A, the parcel tax there, that's different because they have had some financial problems for the past several years.
As well as accreditation issues.
Yeah, and so that's been heavily publicized, and so they're working against that public perception. Public perception of the playgrounds and the park system in the city is by and large pretty good. So you just have a small opposition making more political arguments than policy ones.
And the parcel tax for City College is supposed to help offset a little bit of the financial troubles.
Of the cuts that they've had. But, I mean, a lot of their troubles, unfortunately, from their own making, and just lack of oversight from the Community College Board and from administration and just from everybody. There's sort of been I'm sure you talk to different people, they're going to assign blame to different people. Mm. As someone just watching from the outside, a lot of things have gone wrong there. And there's just, again, a general, when it comes to politics and public opinion, it's not necessarily coupled with what actually happened.
Right. And so, again, this is sort of looking like the argument around the bank bailout, right? Is City College too important to fail versus is bailing it Bailey Goodout going to create a situation that will not allow for significant structural changes that are being called for?
That's right. And there are trustees up for re-election this year too. So it's just going to be interesting to see if incumbents are voted out, if they're kept, if the parcel tax is going to pass. If it's not, there's a lot of things up in the air there.
How's that one polling? How's Proposition A?
Prop A.
Prop A.
I think a lot of people are concerned that that's not going to pass. It needs 55, I believe.
No, it needs 2/3, right? It's a parcel tax.
Is it 2/3?
Yeah,
it's not going to get 2/3.
Yeah.
Somebody told me it was 55.
55 would be if it was a school bond, but it's a parcel tax, so it's a 2/3 vote.
We'll
have our producer look that one
up. Yeah, I would be very fair enough. If it's 2/3, I'd be very. I don't see it getting 67.
But David's point's exactly right, and that's actually one of the problems on 30 was all these issues with state agencies that have been hiding funds and things like that. It's a similar problem that Jerry Brown's having statewide. Is that, you know, when you get in the press with this sort of bad, you know. Bad stories about you, it's tough to then go to voters and say we need more revenue.
Right. And so that was Proposition A. We're going to be looking up what the threshold is there. So we have a caller on the line. Claire from San Francisco wants to talk about the Parks Bill. Claire, welcome to the program.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just calling because I wanted to get a little bit more information. You know, you said that the opposition to Prop B. I'm wondering if you could just elaborate more besides it being a personality conflict or a desire to reinstate oneself in local politics. What exactly would the opposition to Prop B be about?
Thanks so much, Claire, for your call. So David,
so
anything to add there?
The opposition to Prop B is... there's not necessarily an organized opposition to Prop B, but among the more vocal opponents of Prop B is a man named Aaron Peskin, who was the chair of the Democratic Party. He used to be president of the board. He left the Democratic Party Central Committee. He hasn't been in office for a few years. And he's been the most vocal opponent of Proposition B. And he's had conflicts with some of the higher-ups there. And I think there are a lot of people who have had conflicts with some of the folks making decisions there. One of the issues that's come up is privatization of the parks. That's the policy issue on which they've jumped onto, for instance, charging out-of-towners for the conservatory. I think the
Conservatory of Flowers.
Yeah, and that's one of the issues, just the fact that they can let out or rent out some of the public spaces for events, for instance, the X Games, the BMX event that was at City Hall a couple weeks ago, angered some people. So there's an issue of privatization that some people have jumped onto, but it seems to me that's kind of an after the fact. It's people with an axe to grind with some of the city league, because the entire city establishment has endorsed and is behind Prop B, and so there's some folks who seem to have an axe to grind with them who are using issues, you know, using privatization issues, and they're not. It's not that they're not relevant issues, but they're small compared to the overall sort of what the money's supposed to be going toward. There's also some neighborhood opposition, which their main line of argument is our neighborhood's not getting any of the money this time around, so we vote no.
415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on our website klw.org/program/city-visions as we run down the state and local propositions here on Election Eve. I'm Joseph Pache and I'm here with my guests in the studio, David Latterman and Corey Cook of the University of San Francisco. 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So Corey, let's go back now to some of the state propositions. Let's go to Prop 31. This one is an interesting one because it's a hodgepodge of budgeting reform measures, and you can get lost in a lot of the details. And on the surface, it seems like lots of well-intentioned maneuvers.
Right.
Tell us, kind of run them down, and maybe give us a little bit of the devil in the details here. What do people have to know as they're weighing their support or their opposition for this proposition?
So among the many, so as you noted, this was sort of the been put forward by some good government reform groups arguing that this would make the state and local budgeting more rational. The big piece is a two-year budget cycle for the state, which I've forgotten the number, but a dozen or so states already have two-year budget cycles.
And San Francisco does as well.
Yeah, San Francisco just had its first two-year budget right this year as his first version of that. It allows the governor to cut the budget unilaterally during declared fiscal emergencies, which is an interesting provision for California. It changes some of the ways that the state and local governments operate, in part because of the two-year funding cycle. It requires performance audits and things like that of government programs. The various reform groups of the last maybe 4 or 5 years that were pursuing some of the bigger reform agendas in California, the Constitutional Revision Commission and things like that, have been behind this, have been arguing that this is a way of making state budgets more rational.
There's a pay-as-you-go piece as well?
Right. And I think that, the question is whether I think some of the opposition is saying basically either this isn't enough in terms of reform, or we're not sure exactly how all these pieces will play together. And so there's a two-year budget cycle somewhat different than some of the state local reform measures. And so some of the opposition is basically saying we like pieces of it but not all of it. And again, it gets back to this putting a complicated measure like this in front of voters when they know parts but may not necessarily have the expertise to know how the whole fits together is I think one of the big points of opposition on this.
Another area that seemed to stick out for me was that local jurisdictions could decide how state laws and regulations apply to them.
Yes.
And decide kind of what to do with if they came up with these so-called community action plans. They could get some money directed at them and that they could use at their discretion. And so more local power. And then the question is how does that work if local jurisdictions are kind of deciding how they're going to what applies to them or what doesn't from what's handed down from the state. Explain how that could become tricky.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that. Having read a lot about Prop 31, I'm not sure, frankly, that I understand fully how that will take place, because I think there's some differing opinion about exactly how that would occur. So I don't have a clear answer around that myself.
Hmm. So it sounds so how is this one faring in the polls so far?
I haven't seen public polling on 31. I don't know if you have.
No, I haven't either.
So it sounds like something that a lot of people have been wanting to do for a while, and lots of details that perhaps voters may or may not know what they're voting for.
Yeah, I mean, there's some neat pieces in this that I think sort of are things that everybody agrees to. One of the provisions says that all bills have to be published at least 3 days before a vote. That's something that right now those who've been around Sacramento at the end of session know does not happen. So things like that are designed to increase transparency.
That's a maneuver to avoid people sort of tacking things onto bills that have nothing to do with the original purpose of the bill?
Yeah, and then what happens now, they have this gut and amend procedure, basically, where you can literally take a bill about something entirely unrelated and gut it and amend it to be something entirely different and vote it on within moments. Historically, at the end of session, this is one of the things that gets people kind of frustrated. It's one of the things that I think, again, put that on the ballot by itself, everybody will vote for it. The question is, how do these various reforms and ideas that I think independently most people like, how do they fit together?
415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. Let's stay with state propositions. Let's go to 32 next. 32 would prohibit payroll deductions from unions and some certain corporations for basically political purposes. Tell us a little bit more about that, Corey. How does that actually play out? There's been some concern about whether this truly creates a level playing field between unions and corporations. So tell us why.
So, and I'm going to try to be unbiased on 32 as per the charge. The challenge of 32, right, is that the text of it says that both unions and businesses are prohibited from using payroll deductions to take funds for political purposes. Corporations actually don't do this. And so the challenge, of course, is when you say it's a level playing field and applies to both, and actually only one of the two entities actually does this, it's hard to actually make the case that this is actually a balanced proposition. Rather, we know that this is what unions do. And people right now, union members currently have the ability to opt out. If they don't want their funds used for political purposes, they can opt out. What this does is basically require everybody to opt in. And rather than say, basically, I have the right to be a conscientious objector to my union, not use my funds for political purposes, it basically says every time you're going to have a union dues used for political purposes, your union has to, everybody in the union has to actively say that they want to do this. I don't think there's any question this would cripple the ability of unions in California to raise revenue for political purposes.
Pretty straightforward there, from your point of view. How does the whole Citizens United decision factor in here? Should Prop 32 pass? Is this something that actually we as voters can legislate, given the protections of the Citizens United decision, or is that not really related here?
It's not really related here. What Citizens United says is that unions and corporations can spend their treasury funds on political advertising as a form of direct speech. What this says is how the labor union gets their money. It doesn't say how they can spend it. So Citizens United would say once the union has raised its revenue, it can spend it however it wants to in a federal race. This would just impact how they're able to raise their revenue. So under the current court decisions, this would absolutely be permissible by the Supreme Court under what they've already ruled. They would allow 32 to say you can limit how a union raises their revenues, but you could not say, for example, in California, we would not allow unions to exert political speech in an election. And that's where Citizens United and its genre of decisions, Speech Now and the others that fall into play.
David.
But I think you're going to see Citizens United play into this indirectly, in that we've seen the huge super PACs for both candidates at the presidential level, but especially for Mitt Romney. We've just had the unearthing of the $11 million mystery dollars that coming in against Prop 30 from one of the PACs in Arizona. And I think the narrative has become, especially in California, especially in blue states, that Citizens United has opened the floodgates to corporations and more conservative forces spending an awful lot of money on anything they want without disclosure. Whether that's exactly true is irrelevant. That's what people perceive right now. Politics perception is reality. So if suddenly the backdrop is now Citizens United has just created this juggernaut of money, Prop 32, is going to be seen as, a buttress against that. And so I think voters are going to be a lot less. There's been a lot of movement on 32, going down in the last couple of months. And I think one of the reasons for that is because now people are seeing the super PACs play out and some of the more conservative fundraising efforts play out. The union spending is seen as obviously more democratic, more liberal. So I think a lot of voters are willing to say, I might not love that idea, but considering what the super PACs are doing, the other side needs to have some voice in this.
Corey.
There's no question the federal side, I think David's exactly right. This stuff is playing out and has become part of the debate in California. I think, what you've got going on at the federal level because of the Supreme Court is, I think, an amazing storm of things. It's basically, you've got three things coming together. One is the Citizens United, which says basically that corporations and unions can use funds from their treasury directly and can't be limited in spending money. Again, you can be limited in terms of the contributions, but they can spend it however they want to out of their treasury. And this whole equating corporations as protecting corporations' speech as if they're people, which is again something that came up in was a Proposition F in San Francisco's this policy statement about
that.
About that. But the other two things that have happened that aren't Citizens United.
And that's the policy statement saying that San Francisco,
as a matter of principle,
opposes corporate personhood.
We have a lot of principles here.
But there are two other things that have happened that aren't Citizens United. This one thing about 501c4s, which is, as David alluded to, this issue about this organization out of Arizona, which says basically under a different part of the code, the federal code, if you're a social service organization, as Karl Rove's, one of his Crossroads organizations is a super PAC, the other is a 501c4, where they don't have to disclose their donors, is because they have registered as a social service organization. And Rove of others have said what we're doing is just informing the public about issues, and therefore that an education purpose is a primarily social service purpose, and therefore we don't have to disclose. That's not Citizens United, but that's another storm that we see occurring. And then the third one is around these super PACs. And the super PAC, again, wasn't Citizens United. The super PACs was a result of Federal Election Commission regulations in the wake of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act, the McCain-Feingold thing. And basically what they've said is, if you're a political action committee and you raise money and give it to a candidate, it can be regulated. But if you raise money and you just spend it as speech, then the money you raise can be unlimited. So these super PACs, they have to disclose where they get the funds, but they're raising huge, just ungodly sums of money for political advertising. I think all that that's going on federally, the secretness and the huge amounts of money, as well as this notion that corporations are people too, I think has infected California politics. And I think it does, in fact, come up in 32, even though this is actually an unrelated issue.
Okay. 415-841-4134 if you'd like to join our conversation tonight with David Latterman and Corey Cook of the University of San Francisco on the propositions facing Bay Area voters tomorrow, or perhaps those who've already voted. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. And so let's move next to the criminal justice block, so to speak. So last week we covered 34 and 36 on this program, so we're not going to spend too much time on that, and I will refer listeners to our website, kalw.org/programs/city-visions, to a one-hour treatment of the death penalty repeal and the reform of the three strikes law. Let's look at 35. So tell us about Proposition 35, Corey.
So 35 increases criminal penalties for human trafficking and essentially increases this is... It's interesting in that these three are lumped together and, in fact, do, I think, somewhat different things, right? And 35 is sort of the traditional way we do things in California, which is we find something that we find particularly repulsive and we increase mandatory sentencing on it. And so what it does is it includes prison sentences of 15 years to life for human trafficking and includes fines related to human trafficking. So it's, I think, fairly well within the established norm of California, which is that we tend to find something that we, like I said, we find worthy of greater punishment, and we mandate that in state law, which, you know, again, bookended by a moratorium on the, or a ending of the death penalty and a fundamental reform to three strikes, I think is fascinating. It'll be interesting to see potentially voters passing all three of them at the same time, working at cross purposes.
And there's also this issue about having to hand over internet identities. And so what's the buzz around that particular provision?
I don't, about for Prop 35?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know the details of it to that level. I think if that's part of it, I mean, that will be, it's a small part of it. I think just at face value, most people are going to read Prop 35 in California and probably vote to support it. Mm.
Another concern that I've heard about is that the fact that prostitution is removed as a misdemeanor offense, and a lot of law enforcement agencies see that as would impede their ability to get to help get people out of sex work because it just removes that tool. Mm-hmm.
We had something similar in San Francisco a few years ago. We had Prop K, which was basically the legalizing prostitution, and the proponent of it was former District 1 Supervisor Jake McGoldrick. And the idea of it was basically to do the opposite of what you just said, was to make prostitution actually less of a crime in order to help people get off the streets and to make it easier for them. But the drawback of it was it actually impeded...
That's Prop K, I believe.
It was K, yeah. Yeah. And it impeded funds for trafficking, and it would make it harder to go after... pimps, and harder to go after some of the traffickers, and it would change police funding priorities around. And so that's why it went down hard.
Why is this on the ballot? My understanding is that Senator Leno is also working on something around human trafficking. Why is this on the ballot now?
It goes back to Bob's comment, and that legislators doesn't feel like doing its job much anymore. Who knows why is any of this on the ballot, and why aren't legislators doing more, and why do we have 12, 14 ballot measures per year? So I don't know, but I think we can always sort of just safely default to legislators don't feel like legislating this as much as they should be.
Corey, anything to add to that?
Well, I mean, we know one of the major supporters of this is Mark Klass, who, Polly Klass's father, who was also behind the Three Strikes Initiative. I mean, good, bad, or otherwise. I think there's a lot of the organizations supporting victims of human trafficking are obviously on the yes side of this. They've argued that the penalties historically are insufficient. And I think, you know, you're talking about 5-year penalties for human traffic. I think it's fairly clear to say that the penalties right now are not are not particularly high on human trafficking. The question is mandatory minimum sentencing, in this case, the right approach? And again, I think, you know, people, rational people will disagree or about that. But it does, again, it falls in a line, I think, with a lot of the historical way that we do sentencing in California, which is we find these particularly egregious crimes that are under-sentenced, and then we create mandatory sentencing around them.
It's just also to make note here, the former Facebook executive Chris Kelly is also one of the major funders of this proposition. Okay, 415-841-4134. Let's go to George from San Francisco. George actually wants to talk about Proposition 34, so about the repeal of the death penalty. George, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, thanks. And first off, I would love to hear some more talk about mandatory minimums for, like, those, like, white-collar criminals, by the way. I think that would be pretty neat. Anyway.
Not something you see on ballot measures very often.
Well, that was kind of the thing, right? I loved how he was just talking about how, like, our legislators don't legislate. And, like, that, I think that's kind of the problem that I see kind of with 34, right? Because you get these things that have, like, a little clause, like Section 2, it has, like, state law protects a prosecutor even if he or she intentionally sends an innocent person to prison or death row, thus preventing accountability. That's pretty nutty to me. You know, like, I was just wondering if what we can do to get our legislators to legislate or whatever. I don't know, because, like, I don't even know why this is even on the ballot measure, to be perfectly honest. But I've already voted, and, you know. I had to vote no, because, like, it's just too, you know, I want the death penalty to end, but it's a slow death either way, you know, because these guys take 15 years or whatever to get their cases heard, you know, and it's nuts. Anyway, sorry.
Thanks so much for your call. My understanding, Corey, is that the major argument for the repeal of the death penalty is because it's not working, in the sense that the number one cause of death of people on death row is natural causes. It's not actually the death penalty, because of the long road of appeals, and that, in fact, it costs the state a lot of money to support people's right to these appeals, and then also to house them in separate units, and then, of course, on the law enforcement side is the concern that, you know, you're removing the potential deterrence towards crime from the death penalty.
Right. Well, although I was sort of just saying to David, I mean, there's a lot of law enforcement that's now, you know, in favor of Prop 34, including, you know, the district attorney in San Francisco who's played a pretty active role in the SN34 campaign, arguing that, yeah, it doesn't work, doesn't deter crime. And so there's a moral and ethical argument about Prop 34, as well as there are those who say that because it doesn't work, we need to change the provision. You know, you want to save money, you do what Texas does, right? You cut out all the appeals and you get right to it. So there are a lot who say that it doesn't work, and that the solution isn't necessarily to repeal the death penalty. But what I find interesting that this has been on the ballot before in California. I don't know if you've looked at any of the polling on this, but it has a better shot this time than it has in a long time in California.
Yeah, usually this passes or it fails. The support for the death penalty in California is somewhere in the 60s, the mid-60s, and it's always been north of 50% also among Democrats. But I think for the first time you started to see it dip below 50% among Democrats. And so obviously, since there are more Democrats than Republicans, people think that this, you know, it actually may have a shot this time around. It might be close.
And I think there are a number of states, obviously, have the moratoriums on the death penalty. I think, you know, so California's opinion appears to be changing quite a bit on this.
But keep in mind, this is a moral issue, and most people will not be looking at cost per incarceration or appeals. Most people, it's a visceral, I support it or I don't.
So we have a little over 5 minutes left in the program, so I'm going to ask each of you to pick a proposition, one from San Francisco and one from California, that we haven't touched upon that you really think we should dedicate a couple of minutes to. David, why don't you start first? There's C, the Housing Trust Fund. There's the consolidating odd year multiple elections. There's the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir piece.
I'll pick that one.
Okay.
that's an exciting one. Prop F has received a lot of attention, you know, restore Hetch Hetchy or what have you. What the proposition technically says is they're just going to have a little bit of money to study whether or not Hetch Hetchy should be drained. Even that language alone was contentious, because it's on the ballot. The title and summary is a study to see if Hetch Hetchy should be drained, and the restore Hetch Hetchy folks didn't like the fact that it was alluding to the drain issue. But of course, that is what they're ultimately trying to do, and put the water somewhere else. And so this has been a real sort of cross-partisan line storm, because you have environmentalists who do want to see the Hetch Hetchy Valley restored, yet some of the more, so obviously PG&E, who their livelihood is coming off of that reservoir, is strongly against it. Most of the city family as such is against it. And the Bay Guardian, which has always been, you know, blood feud with PG&E, is strongly against this because of the renewable energy coming out of Hetch Hetchy is one of the reasons. So it's been an odd mixture of sort of atypical allies and foes. I expect this to go down. There's been a lot of money spent. There was a thought that a lot of out-of-state and out-of-city money was going to be spent to support this, and there's been some, but it seems like a lot of money has been raised also, and more money to beat this one back.
And concerns about cost, I know, that were raised, and also whether opposing views about whether we can get enough water to replace what would be lost from Hetch Hetchy if there were to be some more water reclamation efforts.
Exactly.
I will point our listeners to a show that we did on this very topic that was on October. I'm sorry, I'm missing that one. We did that recently. I'm sorry, I don't know the date. But anyway, we had an hour on Hetch Hetchy as well. So go to our website for that. Let's try to get in a couple of callers here. Let's go to Nick from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, I was going to ask about, make a comment about 32 and ask about 33, but now I'm kind of curious. Why is it, do you think, that Californians tend to vote no against the two-thirds majority voting no against a tax issue when it's for secured funding, but yet we will probably vote for something like Prop C in San Francisco and pass it, which is really directing general fund money and dedicating it to a housing. I'm just kind of curious why you guys might think that we do this. That's all.
Thanks for your call.
Very quickly, I think voters vote. Some voters do think about what the mechanism for funding is, whether it's a set-aside, whether it's a two-thirds, a tax, a parcel. I think a lot of voters simply vote on the issue itself. Do I support affordable housing? Yes, I like that. You know, the state budget, Sacramento, I'm not so sure I trust them. I think on a lot of – I mean, there's obviously going to be conservatives who are going to be against a lot of tax increases on everything, and some liberals who are going to support everything. And I think most folks simply deal with the issue itself. Just do you like housing? Do you like community college? Do you like other issues? I mean, it's a bit more visceral.
And Corey, you're going to get the last word here. Do you want to pick on a proposition really quickly, or you just want to make a comment?
I want to talk about Proposition 40, because I find that just for fun. I find that
that's whether to accept the redistricting lines.
Yeah, because you know we have San Francisco voters have 25 different choices to make, and one of them is Prop 40, which is put on the ballot by folks who are unhappy with the district lines done by the Citizens Redistricting Commission. And so it's the one referenda on the ballot, which is a yes vote keeps the districts as they are. The no vote says they should be redrawn. What's fun about this is the folks who put it on the ballot have changed their mind. And so they qualified it. They effectively did the kind of research that David does and realized the districts actually are pretty good for Republicans after all. It could be a lot worse. So they qualified it to say, you know, these are bad districts for Republicans. Later decided, well, we actually, they're okay. They could be a lot worse than that. And then themselves wrote the rebuttal to the argument on the ballot measure saying, actually, please don't vote for this, even though we qualified it and asked you to vote for it, which is, to me, is about as fun as these propositions get.
So thanks again to Corey Cook and David Latterman for the University of San Francisco, always, for an informative and enjoyable discussion about tomorrow's elections. So don't forget to vote, and then tune in to KLW starting tomorrow evening at 5 for our live coverage from the Freight and Salvage with Rose Aguilar. This is Joseph Pache. I want to thank Eric Wayne for help as our engineer this evening, and to say thank you and goodbye to Matt Fidler, who's been our great producer with us for quite some time. Our senior producer, Susie Britton, will be off next week and back in a couple weeks. Join us then. This is Joseph Pache. Good night. Have a great week. And happy Election Day.